is any easier for her. She knows what she must do. Why do you think she will see you secretly, but will not marry you? Hardy got up. We've been long enough. We should join the others. Harvey drained his glass, but did not get up yet. I have tried to be friendly, Hardy said. The senator thinks highly of you. He likes the work you have done, and he likes your ideas. I think if he had a free choice, he might... That doesn't matter. He does not have a free choice. And now I've told you. Hardy went out before Randall could say anything. Harvey sat staring at the empty glass. Finally, he stood and threw it to the carpet. Shit, he said. God damn it to hell. When the meeting adjourned, Maureen went outside. There was a fine mist, so fine that she hardly noticed. No one bothered with mist. Visibility was good, several miles, and she could see the snow in the High Sierra and lower. There was snow on Cow Mountain to the south, and that wasn't quite 5,000 feet high. There would be snow in the valley soon. She shivered slightly in the cold wind, but she wasn't tempted to go inside and get warmer clothing. Inside, she'd have to see Harvey Randall again and look away. She didn't want to see anyone or speak to anyone. But she smiled pleasantly as Alice Cox rode by on her big stallion. Then she felt, rather than heard, someone come up behind her. She turned slowly, afraid of whom she'd see.
Cold, Reverend Varley said. You should get a jacket.
I'm all right. She turned to walk away from him and saw the Sierra again. Harvey's boy was up in those mountains. Travelers said the scouts were doing well there. She turned back again. They tell me you can be trusted, she said.
I hope so.
When she didn't say anything else, he added,
Listening to people's troubles is my main business here.
I thought you were in the praying business, she said it cynically, not knowing why she wanted to hurt him.
I am, but it's not a business.
No, it wasn't. Tom Varley pulled his own weight. He could claim a larger share than what he took from his own daily herd, and many of the valley people gave him part of their own rations, which he distributed. He never said how. George thought he was feeding outsiders, but George wouldn't say anything to Tom Varley. George was afraid of him. Priests and magicians are feared in primitive societies. I wish this were really the Day of Judgment, she blurted.
Why?
Because then it would mean something. There's no meaning to any of this. And don't tell me about God's will and His unfathomable reasons.
I won't, if you say you don't want to hear it. But are you sure?
Yes, I tried that. It doesn't work. I can't believe in a God who did this. And there's just no purpose, no reason for anything. She pointed to the snow in the mountains.
Winter will be here. Soon. And we'll live through it, some of us, and another after that, and another. Why bother?
She couldn't stand looking at him. His collie dog eyes were filled with concern and sympathy, and she knew that was what she had wanted from him, but now it was unbearable. She turned and walked away quickly. He followed.
Maureen,
she went on toward the driveway, but he kept pace with her.
Please.
What?
She turned to face him. What can you say? What can I say? It's all true.
Most of us want to live, he said.
Yes, I wish I knew why.
You do know. You want to live too.
Not like this.
Things aren't so bad.
You don't understand.
I thought I'd found something. Life consists of doing one's job. I could believe that. I really could.
But I don't have a job. I am thoroughly and utterly useless.
That's not true.
It is true. It always was true. Even before... Before. I was just existing. Sometimes I could be happy being a part of someone else's life. I could fool myself. But that wasn't any good either. Not really. I was just drifting along, and I didn't see much point in it. But it wasn't too bad. Not then. But the hammer came and took even that away. It took everything away.
But you're needed here, Varley said. Many of these people depend on you. They need you. She laughed.
For what? Al Hardy and Eileen do the work. Dad makes the decisions. And Maureen, she laughed again, Maureen makes people unhappy. Maureen has fits of black depression that spread like the plague. Maureen sneaks around to see her lover and then destroys the poor son of a bitch by not speaking to him in public because she's afraid she'll get him killed. But Maureen doesn't even have the guts to stop fucking. How's that for worse than useless? There was no reaction to her language, and she was ashamed of herself for trying to... To what? It didn't matter. "Isn't it true that you do care for something?" Varley asked. "This lover, he is someone whose life you want to share?" Her smile was bitter. "Don't you understand? I don't know, and I'm afraid to find out. I want to be in love, but I don't think I can be, and I'm afraid even that's gone. And I can't find out because my job is to be the crown princess. Maybe I ought to marry George and be done with it." This time he did react. He seemed surprised. "George Christopher is your lover." "Good God, no. He's the one who'll do the killing." "I doubt that. George is a pretty good man." I'd like to be sure of that. Then I could find out. I could find out if I can still love anyone. And I want to know. I want to know if the hammer took that, too." "I'm sorry. I shouldn't have spoken to you. There's nothing you can do."
"I can listen, and I can tell you that I see a purpose to life. This vast universe wasn't created for nothing, and it was created. It didn't just happen."
"Did the hammer just happen?"
"I don't believe so."
"Then why?"
Varley shook his head.
"I don't know. Perhaps to shock a Washington socialite enough to make her take a strong look at her life. Maybe only that. For you."
"That's crazy. You don't believe that."
"I believe it has a purpose, but that purpose will be different for each of us."
"We'd better go in. I'm freezing."
She turned and walked rapidly past him to the Stone Ranch house.
"I'll see Harvey tonight," she thought, "and I'll tell him. Everything. I have to. I can't stand this any longer."
Journey's End. In the imminent dark age, people will endure hardship, and for the greater part of their time they will be laboring to satisfy primitive needs. A few will have positions of privilege, and their work will not consist in cultivating the soil or in building shelters with their own hands. It will consist in schemes and intrigues, grimmer and more violent than anything we know today, in order to maintain their personal privileges. Roberto Vaca, The Coming Dark Age.
Ding!
The kitchen timer went off, and Tim Hamner put down his book and picked up the binoculars. He had two sets of binoculars in the guard shack, the very powerful day glasses he now carried, and a much larger night glass that didn't magnify so much, but gathered a lot of light. They'd have been perfect field-viewing astronomical glasses, except that there were always clouds, and Tim rarely saw the stars. The hut had been vastly improved. Now there was insulation and more wood frame. It could even be heated. It contained a bed, a chair, a table and some bookshelves, and a rifle rack at the door. Tim slung the Winchester 30-06 over his shoulder on the way out, and only momentarily felt amusement at the thought. Tim Hamner, playboy and amateur astronomer, armed to the teeth as he ventured forth to search out the ungodly. He climbed up onto the boulder. A tree grew next to it. From any distance away, he'd be invisible in the foliage. When he reached the top, he braced himself against the tree and began his careful scan of the terrain below him. Trouble Pass appeared on no maps. It was Harvey Randall's name for the low spot in the ridges surrounding the stronghold. Trouble Pass was the most likely route for anyone invading on foot, and Tim scanned it first. He'd looked into it no more than 15 minutes before. The timer was set for 15-minute intervals on the theory that nobody, on foot or horseback, could get over the pass and out of sight in less than 15 minutes. There was nobody there. There never was these days. In the first weeks, walkers had tried to come in that way, and they'd be spotted, and Tim would use the bugle to sound an alarm. ranchers on horseback would go out to meet the intruders and turn them away. Now the pass was always clear. Still, it had to be watched. Tim spotted 2 deer and a coyote, 5 jackrabbits and a lot of birds. Meat, if hunters could be spared. Nothing else in the pass. He swept the glasses on around, over the tops of the skylines and along the barren hillsides. It wasn't too different from looking for comets. You remember what things ought to look like and search for anything different. Tim knew every rock on the hillsides by now. There was one shaped like a miniature Easter Island statue, and another that looked like a Cadillac. Nothing was on the hillsides that shouldn't be there. He turned and looked down into the valley behind, and grinned again at his good fortune. Better to be a guard on top of the ridge than down there breaking up rocks. "I expect the guards at San Quentin thought that, too," Tim said aloud. He'd taken to talking to himself lately. The stronghold looked good, secure, safe, with greenhouses and grazing herds and flocks, and there was going to be enough to eat. "I am one lucky son of a bitch," Tim said. It came to him, as it often did, that he was far luckier than he deserved. He had Eileen, and he had friends. He had a secure place to sleep and enough to eat. He had work to do, although his first scheme, to rebuild the dams above the stronghold, hadn't worked out. No fault of his. He and Brad Wagoner had worked out new ways to generate electricity, always assuming they could get outside and find the wire and bearings and other tools and equipment they'd need. And books. Tim had a whole list of books that he wished for. He'd owned nearly all of them, back in a time that he barely remembered, a time when all he had to do if he wanted anything was to let someone know it, and let money do the rest. When he thought about books and how easy it had been to get them, his thoughts sometimes strayed further, to hot towels and the sauna and swimming pool, Tanqueray gin and Irish coffee, and clean clothes whenever he wanted them. But those times were hard to remember. They were times before Eileen, and she was worth a lot. If it took the end of the world to bring them together, then maybe it was worth it. Tim was sad only when he thought of life outside, when he remembered the dead baby and the police and nurses working at the Burbank Hospital. Those memories of driving past helpless people sometimes rose to haunt him, and he couldn't help wondering why he'd survived. More than survived. Lived to find security and a lot more happiness than he'd ever expected. Movement caught his eye. A truck was coming up the road. It was full of men, and Tim almost leaped down into the hut to call a warning. The air was clear of lightning except for the constant flashes up in the High Sierra. The little CB radio would work, but he wasn't supposed to use it more than necessary. It was damned tough hauling batteries up and down this hill, and it took precious gasoline to recharge them. He let the impulse pass. The truck had a way to go. There was a time to examine it through the binoculars. He didn't doubt that it was Deke Wilson's truck. He looked anyway. A single truck could carry considerable firepower, and a single such mistake could cost a score of lives and put the poor stuttering sentry back on the road without his balls. It looked like Deke's truck, more crowded than usual. The truck bed was jammed with standing men. You wouldn't crowd an attack force together like that. One was a woman. Those 4, why did they leap to the eye like that? One was a woman, and one was black, and 2 were white men. But the 4 seemed clumped together as if in mutual distaste for the mortals around them. No, they didn't look like mortals. Tim shifted his elbows on the rock and studied elusively familiar faces through the binoculars. But the truck was coming too close. Tim sprinted for the hut. He was picking up the microphone when he remembered.
"Yeah?"
"Deke Wilson's here. 3 minutes," said Tim. "And he's got the astronauts with him. The astronauts from Hammer Lab. All 4. Chet, you won't believe them. They look like gods. They look like they never went through the end of the world at all." Faces. Dozens of faces, all white, all staring up at them in the truck. They were all talking at once, and Rick Delante heard only snatches of conversation. Russians.
astronauts. It's really them.
When he got down from the truck, they crowded around, hanging back a bit to avoid crushing the men from space, staring, smiling. Men and women, and they weren't starving. Their eyes did not have the haunted look that Rick had got used to at Deke Wilson's place. These people had only seen a part of hell. They were mostly middle-aged, and their clothes showed signs of hard work and not much washing. The men tended to be large, the women plain, or was it only that they were dressed for work? At Deke Wilson's farm, the women had dressed like men and worked like men. Here there was a difference. In this valley, women were different from men. It wasn't like the world before Hammerfall. It wasn't that obvious, and if Rick hadn't been weeks with Deke Wilson, he would have reflected on how things had changed since the Hammer. Now he noticed the similarities. This valley was as different from Wilson's fortified camp as... Rick had no more time to reflect on it. There were introductions, and they were ushered up onto the big porch of the Stone Ranch House. Rick would have known who was in charge even if he hadn't recognized Senator Jellison. The senator was not as large as the big, burly men, but everyone made room for him, waited for him to speak first, and his smile made them all feel welcome. Even Peter and Leonila, who had been dreading this meeting. More people were coming, some downhill from the fields, others up the drive. The word must have spread fast. Rick looked for Johnny Baker and saw him, but Baker wasn't noticing Rick Delante or anyone else. He was standing in front of a slim girl, tall, red hair, flannel shirt, and work trousers. He gripped both her hands, and they devoured each other with their eyes.
"I was sure you were dead," Baker said. "I never even asked Deke. I was afraid to. I'm glad you lived."
"I'm glad you lived, too," she said.
Odd, Rick thought. From the sorrow on their faces, you would have thought they were attending each other's funeral. It was obvious to Rick and to everyone else they had been lovers. And some of the men didn't like that at all. Trouble building there." Rick again had no time to reflect on it. The crowd was pressing around, everyone speaking at once. One of the big men turned from watching Johnny and his woman and spoke to Rick.
"Are we at war with the Russians?" he demanded.
"No," Rick said.
"What's left of Russia and what's left of the United States are allies, against China. But you can forget about all that. The war's long over. Between the Hammer and the Soviet missiles, and we think maybe some of our own... there won't be anything left of China that can fight back."
"Allies?" The big man was bewildered.
"Okay, I guess."
Rick grinned at him.
"The thing is, if we ever get to Russia, we'll find nothing but glaciers. But if we go to China, we'll find Russians, and they'll remember us as allies. See?"
The man scowled and walked away, exactly as if Rick had been putting him on. Rick Delante fell into the old routine. He was used to speaking at gatherings, keeping the words simple and the imagery vivid, explaining without condescending. There were plenty of questions. They wanted to know what it was like in space. How long did it take to get used to freefall? Rick was surprised at how many had watched their TV broadcasts from Hammer Lab and remembered Rick's impromptu zero-G ballet performance. How did they move? Eat? Drink? Patch a meteor strike? Couldn't that raw sunlight burn your eyes out? Did they wear dark glasses all the time? He learned the names. The young girl was Alice Cox. The woman with the tray of hot coffee, real coffee, was her mother. The burly men with the challenging stance were both Christophers, and so was the one who'd wanted to know about the war. Only that one had gone inside with Deke Wilson and Johnny Baker, leaving Mrs. Cox to be hostess. There was a man introduced as Mayor, and another whom everyone called Chief. But there was something subtle Rick didn't understand, because the Christophers, with no title, seemed to have higher status. All the men seemed big, and they were all armed. Was he already so used to the half-starved look of Deke Wilson's band?
"The Senator says we can spare some light," Mrs. Cox announced after one of her trips inside. "You can talk to the astronauts after it's too dark to work, and maybe we'll have a party Sunday."
There were murmurs of agreement and goodbyes, and the crowd melted away. Mrs. Cox took them inside and brought more coffee into the living room. The perfect hostess, and Rick found himself relaxing for the first time since they had landed. At Deke Wilson's there had been coffee, but not much, and it was consumed hurriedly by men about to go on guard duty. No one sat relaxed in a parlor, and the coffee certainly wasn't served in china cups.
"I'm sorry there's nobody around to keep you company," Mrs. Cox said. "Everyone's got work to do. They'll be back tonight, and then they'll talk your head off."
"It is not important," Peter said. "We thank you for the welcome."
He and Leonilla sat together, apart from Rick.
"I hope we are not keeping you from your duties."
"Well, I've got dinner to cook," Mrs. Cox said. "If you want anything, just call me."
She left them alone, pointedly setting down the coffee cup.
"Better drink that before it gets cold," she said. "I can't promise there'll be any more for a while."
"Thank you," Leonilla said. "You are all so kind to us."
"No more than you deserve, I'm sure,"
Mrs. Cox answered, and then she was gone.
"So, we have found a government," Peter said. "Where is General Baker?"
Rick shrugged. "Back there somewhere with Deke and the Senator and some of the others. Big conference."
"To which we were not invited," Jakov said. "I understand why Leonilla and I are not needed, but why are you out here?"
"I thought about that," Rick said. "But they all left pretty quick. You know what Deke's got to tell them, and somebody had to stay out there and talk to the crowd. I took it as a compliment."
"I hope you are right," Jakov said.
Leonilla nodded agreement.
"This is the first time I have felt safe since we landed. I think they like us. Surely they do not care that Rick is black."
"I can usually tell," Rick said. "No. But there was something strange. Did you notice? After they found out about the war, all they wanted to know about was space. Nobody at all asked about what was happening to the Earth."
"Yes, but soon we will have to tell them," Peter said.
"I wish we could avoid that," Leonilla said. "But yes, we will have to."
They fell silent. Rick got up and poured the last of the coffee. From back in the kitchen there were sounds of activity, and outside they could see men carrying rocks, others plowing fields. Hard work, and it was certain that there'd be plenty for all of them, even Leonilla. Rick hoped so. He realized that he had been silently praying that there would be work, something to do, something to make him feel useful again, and to forget Houston and El Lago and the tsunami. But for the moment he'd been given a hero's welcome, and so had Leonilla and Peter, and they were safe, surrounded by armed men who didn't want to kill them. He heard a low buzz of voices from somewhere at the back of the house. That would be the Senator and Johnny Baker and Deke Wilson and the Senator's trusted staff, planning... what? Our lives, Rick thought. Was the Senator's daughter there, too? Rick remembered how she and Johnny had looked at each other. Their voices inaudible, their noses almost touching. No thought of anyone around them. How would that affect the Senator's decisions? It struck Rick that the Senator might like it fine. Johnny Baker was an Air Force general. If Colorado Springs had the power they claimed, that could be important.
"How many men here?" Peter said.
The question startled Rick from his reverie.
"I estimate several hundred," Peter was saying, "and many weapons. Do you think that is enough?"
Rick shrugged. He'd been thinking of the far future, weeks, months ahead, and had almost managed to forget why they had come to the Senator's stronghold just now.
"It's got to be," Rick said, and now he felt it too, the tension that Peter and Leonilla had brought with them. It had never occurred to Rick that the Senator wouldn't have enough strength. He'd been so sure that somewhere there were civilized men and women— real safety and civilization and order. And maybe there wasn't any. Anywhere.
Rick shuddered slightly, but he kept his smile in place, and the three of them sat in the paneled room, waiting and hoping.
"They call themselves the New Brotherhood Army," said Deke.
He looked around him, at Harvey Randall and Al Hardy and General Johnny Baker. George Christopher, who sat far to one side of the room, and Senator Jellison in his judge's chair, and his eyes were haunted. He drank from his glass and waited a minute while the whiskey worked its ancient magic, and said in a firmer voice, "They also claim to be the legal government of California." "By what authority?" Al Hardy demanded. "Well, their proclamation was signed by the lieutenant governor. Acting governor, he calls himself now." Hardy frowned. "The Honorable James Wade Montrose." "That's the name," Deke said. "Could I have some more of that whiskey?" Hardy looked to the senator, got a nod, and refilled Deke's glass. "Montrose," Al said musingly. "So the screwball survived." He looked to the others and added quickly, "An insider's joke. In politics, we usually have nicknames for people. The loser, grin and bear it. Montrose got tagged as the screwball." "Screwball or not, he's given me 7 days to join his government," Deke said. "Otherwise, his new Brotherhood army will take the whole place by force." The farmer opened his army surplus field jacket and took a paper from an inner pocket. The paper was mimeographed, but the lettering was hand-drawn in fine calligraphy. He handed it to Al Hardy, who glanced at it, then gave it to Senator Jellison. "That's Montrose's signature," Hardy said. "I'm sure of it." Jellison nodded. "We can treat the signature as genuine." He looked up to include everyone in the conversation. "The lieutenant governor proclaims a state of emergency and asserts what amounts to supreme authority within California," he said. George Christopher growled, a harsh, grating sound.
"Over us, too?"
"Everyone," Jellison said. "He mentions the Colorado Springs announcement, too. Do you know anything about that, General Baker?" Johnny Baker nodded. He sat next to Harvey Randall, but he didn't seem to be part of the group in the room. "The old gods have returned," Harvey thought. "For the moment, anyway. How long will they be gods?" Harvey had seen Baker with Maureen and hated it.
"We caught a broadcast out of Colorado Springs," Baker said. "I'm sure it was genuine. It was in the name of the Speaker of the House."
"A senile idiot," Al Hardy said.
"Who is acting as president," the astronaut continued. "His chief of staff seems to be a brevet lieutenant general named Fox. I think that's Byron Fox, and if it is, I know him. One of the professors at the academy. Good man."
George Christopher had been quietly fuming. Now he spoke, his voice low and full of anger.
"Montrose, that son of a bitch. He was around here a couple of years ago trying to organize the pickers. Came right onto my land. I couldn't even throw the trespassing bastard off. He had 50 state cops with him."
"I'd say Jimmy Montrose has quite a lot of legal power," Senator Jellison said. "He is the highest-ranking civil officer in California, assuming the governor's dead, and he probably is."
"Sacramento's gone, then?"
Johnny Baker asked. Al Hardy nodded. "As far as we can tell, that area's all underwater. Harry took a sweep north and west a couple of weeks ago and met somebody who'd talked to people who tried to get to Sacramento. All they found was more of the San Joaquin Sea."
"Damn,"
Baker said.
"Then the nuclear power plant's gone."
"Yes, sorry," Hardy said.
"Deke, you're not going to knuckle under this goddamn Montrose, are you?"
George Christopher demanded.
"I came here to ask for help," Wilson said. "They can whip us. That army of his is big."
"How big?" Al Hardy asked.
"Big."
"Something puzzles me," Senator Jellison said. "Deke, are you certain that the cannibal band you fought is part of this outfit that Montrose is associated with?"
"I said so, didn't I?"
"Now don't get upset." The senator's famous charm was suddenly evident. "It just surprised me, that's all. Montrose was a screwball, but he wasn't crazy, or stupid for that matter. He championed the underdog," there was a growl from Christopher.
"Or so he claimed," Jellison continued smoothly, "but I wouldn't have thought he'd be friendly with cannibals."
"Maybe they're holding him prisoner," Al Hardy suggested. Jellison nodded.
the point I was about to make, in which case he has no legal authority at all.
Legal Schmeagle, what do I do? Deke Wilson asked. I can't fight him. Will you people help me? I don't want to give in to them.
Don't blame you, Christopher said.
It's not just the cannibals, Deke said. They may give that up if they can get other food, but some of those messengers.
How big a party did they send? Hardy asked.
About 200 camped down the road from us, Deke said. They sent in a dozen, all armed. General Baker saw them, a captain of state police.
No shit, Christopher exclaimed. State cops with the cannibals.
Well, he wore the uniform, Deke said. And some guy who'd been an official in Los Angeles, a black man, and others. Most of them were okay, but two were... hell, they were weird.
He looked to Baker and got a nod of agreement.
Really weird, Deke continued. Acted like they were on dope. The eyes looked like that, wide, you know, and they wouldn't look straight at you. And they talked about the angels of the Lord. The angels have sent us to deliver this message.
How did the others react to that? Harvey Randall asked.
Like nothing happened. Like it was normal to talk about the angels sending them. And when I asked what the hell that meant, they just turned and left.
You have the message. That's all they'd say. And you said there were 200 camped near you? Al Hardy asked. How near? Where?
Not far. South, down the road, Deke said. Why?
Harry went out your way. Hardy said.
He's not overdue. He doesn't keep any exact schedule, but we've been expecting him.
He never got to my place, Deke said.
Do you think this outfit has done anything to Harry? Jellison asked.
Deke shrugged.
Senator, I don't know what to make of those people. They claim to have a lot more troops than the ones they let us see, and I believe it. We don't see traitors anymore. No refugees. It's like there's nobody out there except you and the new Brotherhood.
Angels, Al Hardy said. It doesn't make much sense. Not neat, Harvey Randall thought. Not neat at all, and it disturbs Al.
I met Montrose a few times, Harvey said. He didn't seem crazy to me. He was hyped on the subject of environmentalism, spray cans destroying the ozone, that kind of thing. Maybe the hammer drove him over the edge. He may be crazy, he may be a prisoner. Anything could be, Deke Wilson said. But there's 200 men camped down the road. I'd bet they've got 500 more, and I don't know what the hell to do.
No, I don't suppose you do, the senator said. He paused for thought, and no one interrupted him. Presently, he said,
Well, 6 more days. Deke, I was going to make you an offer. You could bring your women and children and injured here, and your part would be to salvage things for us. Tools, electronics, that sort of thing. Starting with scuba gear you could use to dive for...
Where does that leave us time to fight the new Brotherhood army, Senator? Jellison sighed.
It doesn't, of course, and I don't suppose that Governor Montrose, or whoever is controlling him, will be interested in sharing your salvage with us. It sounds as if he intends to take control of the whole state.
Including our valley, George Christopher said.
Yes, I expect so, Jellison said. Well, 2 governments we've discovered today. Colorado Springs and the new Brotherhood Army. Plus the possibility of angels.
So what the hell do I do?
Deke demanded.
Be patient. We don't know enough, Jellison said. Let's get some more data. General Baker, what can you tell us about the rest of the United States? The rest of the world, for that matter.
Johnny Baker nodded and leaned back to organize his thoughts.
We never did have much for communications, he said. We lost Houston right after Hammerfall. Colonel Delante's family was killed in that, by the way. I'd go easy on asking him about Texas.
Baker was pleased to see that the others still had enough sensitivity to show sympathy for Rick.
From what he had seen out there, most of the world couldn't find tears to shed for a few individuals. There was too much death. My Russian friends also lost their families, Johnny said. The war started less than an hour after the hammer struck.
China hit Russia. Russia hit China. A few of our missile bases launched at China, too.
Jesus, Al Hardy said.
Harvey, have you got anything that would measure radiation?
No. They all looked alarmed. Harvey nodded agreement.
We're right in the fallout pattern, he said, but I don't know what we should do about it.
Is there anything we can do about it? Hardy asked.
I think it's safe, Johnny Baker said. Rain settles fallout, and there's plenty of rain. The whole world looks like a big ball of cotton. We hardly ever saw the ground after the hammer fell.
You mentioned communications, Jellison prompted.
Yes, sorry. Well, we talked to Colorado Springs, but it was very short, not much more than exchanging IDs. We got a SAC base, once, in Montana. They hadn't had any communications with anyone, and that's all in the U.S.
He paused to let that sink in.
As for the rest of the world, South Africa and Australia are probably in good shape. We don't know about Latin America. None of us knew enough Spanish, and when we did get contact with somebody down there, it didn't last long. We got some commercial radio broadcasts, though, and as near as we can make out, they're having a revolution a week in Venezuela, and the rest of the continent's got political problems, too.
Jellison nodded.
Hardly surprising. And, of course, their most important cities were on the coasts. I don't suppose you know how high the tsunamis got in the southern hemisphere.
No, sir, but I'd guess they were big, Johnny Baker said. The one that hit North Africa was over 500 meters high. We saw that just before the clouds covered everything. 500 meters of water sweeping across Morocco.
He shuddered.
Europe's gone. Completely. Oh, and the volcanoes in Central and South America let go. The smoke came right up through the clouds. The whole ring of fire has let go. You've got volcanoes east of you, somewhere out in Nevada, I think. And up north of here, Mount Lassen and Mount Hood, and maybe Rainier. A lot of them in Northern California and Oregon and Washington. He went on, and as he spoke, they realized just how alone they were. The Imperial Valley of California, gone, with a hammer strike in the Sea of Cortez that sent, had to have sent, waves washing clear up to the Joshua Tree National Monument in the mountains west of Los Angeles. Scratch Palm Springs and Palm Desert and Indio and 29 Palms, forget about the valley of the Colorado River. And something must have hit in Lake Huron, Baker said. We saw the usual spiral pattern of clouds with a hole in the center, just before everything turned white.
Is there anything left of this country outside Colorado? Al Hardy asked.
Don't know again, Baker said. With all that rain, I'd think the Midwest is drowned out. No crops, no transportation, lots of people starving.
And killing each other for what's left, Al Hardy said. He looked at each of the others in turn, and they all nodded agreement. The stronghold was lucky. More than luck, because they had the senator, and they had order. A tiny island of safety in a world that had very nearly been killed.
Why us? Harvey Randall wondered.
Johnny Baker's report hadn't surprised him, not really. He had thought it out long before. There was the matter of no radio communications. True, the constant static made it unlikely they'd receive messages, but there ought to be something, once in a while, and there almost never was, which had to mean that nobody was broadcasting, not with any real power, not constantly. But it was different to know they were one of the few pockets of survivors. What had happened to the world? A revolution a week in Latin America. Maybe that was the answer everywhere. What the hammer and the Sino-Soviet war hadn't done, people were busily doing to themselves. Al Hardy broke the silence.
It doesn't look as if the U.S. cavalry will come charging over the hill to rescue us.
Deke Wilson's laugh was bitter.
The army's turned cannibal, what we saw of it anyway.
We'll have to fight, George Christopher said.
That goddamn Montrose.
George, you can't be sure he's in charge, Al Hardy said.
Who cares? If he's not, it's worse. It's the fucking cannibals. We'll have to fight sooner or later. We may as well do it while we've got Deke's people on our side.
I'll go for that, Deke Wilson said. Unless...
Unless what?
Christopher asked, his voice suddenly suspicious. Wilson spread his hands. Harvey couldn't help noticing. Wilson had been a big man, who was now two sizes too small for his body and clothes. And he was scared.
Unless you'll let us in, Wilson said, we can hold that gang off. You've got hills to defend. I don't. All I've got is what I can build. No ridgelines, no natural boundaries, nothing. But in here, we can hold the bastards off until they starve to death. Maybe we can help that along. Go on raids and burn out what they've stored up.
That's obscene, Harvey Randall said.
Aren't there enough people starving without burning crops and food? Jesus, all over the world, what the hammer didn't get, we're doing to ourselves. Does it have to happen here, too?
We couldn't feed all of your people for the winter, Deke, Hal Hardy said.
Sorry, but I know. The margin's just too thin. We can't do it.
We don't know enough, not yet, Jellison said. Maybe it's possible to come to terms with the new Brotherhood.
Bullshit, George Christopher said.
It is not bullshit, Harvey Randall said.
I knew Montrose, and damn it, he is not crazy. He is not a cannibal. And he is not an evil man, even if he did come onto your land and try to help the farm workers organize a union.
That will do,
Jellison said. He was very firm about it.
George, I suggest that we wait for Harry. We have to know more about conditions out there. I gather that Deke knows almost nothing he hasn't told us. Harvey, have you time to help, or do you have other work?
Jellison's tone made it plain that Harvey Randall wouldn't be needed in the library just now.
If you can spare me, there are a few things.
Harvey got up and went to the door. He almost chuckled when he heard George Christopher coming behind him.
I'll see the maps when they're done, Christopher was saying. I have some work, too. Nice to meet you, General Baker.
He followed Harvey out.
Just a minute.
Harvey walked slowly, wondering what would happen now. The senator had obviously been unhappy about Harvey's outburst. As well he might have been, Harvey thought, and he tried to separate us, and it didn't work.
So what do we do now?
Christopher was saying.
Harvey shrugged. We just don't know enough. Besides, we do have a few days. Maybe if we went out with Deke, we could come up with enough fertilizer and greenhouse materials to keep all of Deke's people going through the winter.
That wasn't what I was talking about, Christopher said. We're going to have to fight those damned cannibals, and we may as well do it before they get any stronger. Take every gun and every man big enough to carry one and go out there and get it the hell over with. I don't want to spend the winter looking over my shoulder. When somebody scares you, there's only one thing to do. Knock him down and stomp on him until he can't hurt you any more.
Or run like hell. Or talk a lot, Harvey thought, but he didn't say anything.
I used to get nervous about you and Maureen, George said.
I want her too, Harv said. He stopped short of the closed kitchen door and stood facing Christopher in the narrow hallway.
If you knock me down and stomp on me a lot, we're all going to be terribly embarrassed.
Your move. Not yet. When you get me mad enough, you'll be for the road. Right now, we've both got a problem.
Yeah, I noticed that too, said Harvey.
Are you going to put him on the road? Don't be stupid. He's a hero. Come on outside.
Christopher led the way through the kitchen. There was no one there at the moment. They went out into the dusk.
Look, Randall, Christopher said, you don't like me much.
No, I expect it's mutual.
Christopher shrugged. I got nothing against you. I don't think you'll shoot me in the back or slug me when I'm not looking.
Thanks.
And unless you do, you can't lick me. Question is, suppose she decides to marry General Baker. What'll you do about that?
Cry a lot.
Look, I'm trying to be polite, Christopher said.
Well, what do you want me to say? Harvey asked.
If she marries Baker, she marries Baker, that's all. And you'll leave her alone, not sneak around seeing her.
Why the hell would I do that? Harvey demanded.
Look, you think I'm some kind of bumpkin fool, don't you?
Christopher said.
And maybe I am, the way you see things. I lived out here before I had to. Went to church, minded my own business. No swinging parties, no girlfriend in every city to go see on expense accounts. Harvey laughed. I didn't live that way, he said. You've been reading too many Playboys. Yeah. Look, Randall, I'm a cornball, I guess. But I happen to think that if a man's married, he stays at home. Now, I never got married. Engaged once, but it didn't work. And then I found out Maureen got her divorce, and while I wasn't exactly just waiting for her, I knew better than to think she'd want to come live in this valley again, or that I could live in Washington. I never found anybody. Then this happened. Now she has to live here. Maybe she could live with me. We would have married once, only it didn't quite work. We were too young. Why are you telling me all this? Because I've got something to say. Damn it, Randall, if I ever do get married, I'll stay married. Yeah, and I'll be faithful to my wife, too. Maybe Baker will be. You sure as hell wouldn't. Now what the hell? I know what goes on in this valley, Randall. I knew before the goddamn comet hit us, and I know now. So you just leave Maureen alone. You're not the kind of man she needs. Why not? And who appointed you the guardian of public morals? I did. And you're not good enough for her. You sleep around. All right, it was with her. I don't like that, but I had no claim on her. Not then. But you were a married man, Randall. What the hell was Maureen to you? Another one to add to your scorecard. Look, I'm getting myself upset, and I didn't want that. But you leave her alone. I'm telling you, leave her be. He turned and walked away before Harvey could say anything else. Harvey Randall stood in shock and barely restrained himself from running after the big rancher. I ought to be mad, he thought. I ought to hate the bastard. But he didn't. Instead, he felt a wild impulse to run and catch up and explain that it hadn't been that way at all, that Harvey Randall thought about marriage the same way George Christopher did, and all right, so he and Maureen had. Had what? Harvey wondered. Maybe Christopher was right. But Loretta never knew, and she wasn't harmed, and neither was Maureen, and it's all a pile of excuses because you knew damned well what you were doing. Instead, he went into the living room to talk with the other astronauts. Exile's Story. When the sun shall be folded up, and when the stars shall fall, and when the wild beasts shall be gathered together, and when the leaves of the book shall be unrolled, and when hell shall be made to blaze, and paradise brought near, every soul shall know what it hath produced, and by the night when it cometh darkening on, and by the dawn when it brighteneth, whither then are ye going? The Holy Koran.
Hot water to soak your feet in, said Harry. Cooked food, a change of clothes, and man, they need you, and they'll know it.
I'll make it, Dan Forrester puffed. I feel light. As a feather, without that pack. And they've got sheep.
He'd been afraid to look at his feet these last few days, but in a while he wouldn't need them. They'd served him well. As for his insulin stock, well, he'd had to increase the dosage. It must be deteriorating.
Have they got a working refrigerator?
Refrigerator, no. Sheep, yes. We'll have to deal with that right away. Won't be long now. That's the roadblock ahead.
Their companion, striding ahead of them on the deserted road with Dan Forrester's backpack riding lightly on his hips, stopped suddenly and glanced back.
You're with me, Harry said. It'll be all right.
Hugo Beck nodded, but he waited for Dan and Harry to catch up. He was afraid, and it showed. There was a sign 50 yards from the log barricade. It said, Danger. You are entering guarded land. Go no further. If you have business here, walk slowly to the barricade and stand still. There will be no warning shots fired. Keep your hands in plain sight at all times. Under it was another, in Spanish, and beyond that, a large death's head with the universal traffic symbol for
Do not enter. Strange welcome, Matt, Dan Forrester said. Rotation of work. Mark Chescu was enjoying his day of guard duty while someone else made little rocks out of big ones. It wasn't always fun, though. Earlier, there had been a family on bicycles who had won their way through the San Joaquin and had tales of cannibals and worse, and Mark hadn't much enjoyed turning them away. He'd shown them the road north, where there was a fishing camp that was just hanging on to life. Four people. The stronghold could feed four more, but which four? If these, why not more? The decision was right. Take in no one without special reasons. But it didn't make it any easier to look a man in the eye and send him up the road. Mark sat behind a screen of logs and brush where he could watch without being seen. His partners watched him. One of these days, Bart Christopher was going to be slow, and they'd lose the front man at the gate. There were three figures coming up the road, and Mark came out when he recognized the remnants of a gray U.S. Postal Service uniform. He hailed Harry joyfully, but his smile had vanished when the three trudged up to the barrier. He was looking at Hugo Beck when he said, "Happy Trash Day, Harry." "I brought him," Harry said. He said it belligerently. "You know the rules. He's got my safe conduct, and this is Dr. Dan Forrester." "Hi, Doc," Mark said. "You and your damned hot fudge sundae." Forrester managed the ghost of a smile. "He's got a book," Harry said. "He's got a lot of books, but this one he brought with him. Show him, Dan." It was drizzling lightly. Dan didn't open the tape seals. Mark read the title through four layers of baggies. The Way Things Work, Volume 2.
"Volume 1 is in a safe place," Dan said, "with 4,000 other books on how to put a civilization together."
Mark shrugged. He was pretty sure they'd want Dan Forrester up at the stronghold anyway, but it would be nice to know what other gifts Forrester had available.
"What kind of books?"
"The 1911 Britannica," Forrester said. "An 1894 book of formulae for such things as soap, with a whole section on how to brew beer, starting with barley grains. The Beekeeper's Manual. Veterinary handbooks. Instructor's lab manuals, starting with basic inorganic chemistry and running up through organic synthesis. I've got those for 1930 equipment as well as modern. The amateur radio handbook, farmer's almanac, the rubber handbook, Peter's Pour Yourself a House, and two books on how to make Portland cement, the complete gunsmith, and a set of army field manuals on infantry weapon maintenance, the maintenance manuals for most cars and trucks, Wheeler's home repairs, three books on hydroponic gardening, a complete set of..."
"Whoa!" Mark cried. "Enter, O Prince! Welcome back, Harry. They're getting worried about you up at the big house. Put your hands on the rail, Hugo. Spread your legs. You carrying heat?"
"You saw me unload the pistol," Hugo said. "It's in the waistband. And the kitchen knife. I need that for eating."
"We'll just put those in the bag," Mark said. "You probably won't be eating here. I won't say goodbye, Hugo. I'll see you on the way out."
"Up your nose," Mark shrugged.
"What happened to your truck, Harry?"
"They took it."
"Somebody took your truck? Did you tell them who you were?"
Mark was incredulous.
"Hell, this means war. They were wondering whether to take a big force outside. Now they'll have to."
"Maybe."
Harry didn't seem as pleased as Mark thought he would. Dan Forrester cleared his throat.
"Mark, did Charlie Sharps get here all right? There would have been a couple of dozen people with him."
"Was he coming here?"
"Yes, Senator Jellison's ranch."
"We never saw him."
Mark looked embarrassed. So did Harry. It must be common enough to them, Dan thought sadly. Someone never got somewhere, and the only question was, would the survivor make a scene? Harry broke an uncomfortable silence.
"I've got a message for the senator, and Dr. Forrester isn't walking so good. Have you got transportation?"
Mark looked thoughtful.
"Guess we'd better telegraph that request in," he said. "Wait here. Watch the road for me, Harry. I'll be right back."
Mark spread both hands wide and waved from his waist, making it look casual, like a shrug,
so that Hugo Beck wouldn't figure out that he was signaling, then went off into the bushes. Dan Forrester watched with interest. He'd read his Kipling. He wondered if Hugo Beck had. The sun was falling behind the mountains. Golden light and violent reds showed beneath the edges of the cloud cover. Sunrises and sunsets had been spectacular since Hammerfall, and Dan Forrester knew they would be for a long time. When Tambura blew up in 1814, the dust it sent into the sky kept sunsets brilliant for 2 years, and that was only one volcano. Dan Forrester sat in the cab of the truck with the taciturn driver. Harry and Hugo Beck were in back under a tarpaulin. There was no other traffic on the road, and Forrester appreciated the compliment they'd paid him. Or was it for Harry? Perhaps both together were worth the gasoline when neither alone would have been. They drove through a light drizzle, and the truck heater felt good on Dan's feet and legs. There were no dead bodies. It was the first thing Dan noticed. Nothing dead to be seen. The houses looked like houses, with someone living in every one of them. A few had sandbagged defenses, but there were many that had no signs of defenses at all. Strange, almost weird, that there should be a place where people felt safe enough to have glass windows without shutters. And he saw two flocks of sheep, as well as horses and cattle. He saw signs of organized activity everywhere, newly cleared fields, some being plowed with teams of horses, no tractors that he could see. Others still in process of clearing, with men working to carry boulders and pile them into stone walls. The men generally had weapons on their belts, but not all of them were armed. By the time they came to the large driveway up to the big stone house, it had sunk in. For a few minutes, possibly for as much as a whole day, Dan Forrester was safe. He could count on living until dawn. It was a strange feeling. There were men waiting for them on the porch. They waved Dan Forrester on into the house without speaking to him. George Christopher jerked his thumb at Harry.
"They need you inside," he said.
In a minute, Harry helped Hugo Beck get down from the truck, then lifted off Forrester's backpack. When he turned, George had his shotgun pointed at Hugo's midsection.
"I brought him," Harry said. "You must have heard that on the telegraph."
"We heard about Dr. Forrester. Not this creep. Beck, you were put on the road. I sent you out myself. Didn't I remember to say, 'Don't come back'? I'm sure I did."
"He's with me," Harry repeated.
"Harry, have you lost your mind? This scummy little thief isn't worth—"
"George, if I have to start going around Christopher territory, the senator will no doubt tell you any news he thinks you should hear."
"Don't push it," George said.
But the shotgun moved slightly, so it wasn't pointed at anyone.
"Why?"
"You can put him back on the road if you like," Harry said, "but I think you should listen to him first."
Christopher thought about it for a moment, then he shrugged.
"They're waiting inside. Let's go."
Hugo Beck stood before his judges.
"I came bringing information," he said, too softly.
His judges were few. Deke Wilson, Al Hardy, George Christopher, and the others. It struck Harry as it had the rest. The astronauts looked like gods. Harry recognized Baker from his photograph on the cover of Time, and it wasn't hard to know who the others were. The lovely woman who didn't speak must be the Soviet cosmonaut. Harry burned to talk to her. Meanwhile, there were other things to be said.
"Do you know what you're doing, Harry?"
Al Hardy asked. His tone made it a sincere question, as if he were half certain that Harry had lost his mind.
"You're the information service, not Beck."
"I know," Harry said. "I thought you should have this firsthand. It's a little hard to believe."
"And that I can believe," George Christopher said.
"Don't I get a seat?" Harry asked.
Hardy waved him toward a chair, and Harry settled back, wishing that Hugo would show more backbone. His behavior reflected on Harry. This reception wasn't what Harry was used to, and it was Beck that caused it. No china cups and coffee, no shot of whiskey. The balance of power was life and death at the stronghold. One played the game well or stayed out of it. Harry tried to stay out of it, enjoy his utility without getting involved in local politics. This time he'd had to play. Had he seriously offended Christopher? And did he give a damn? It was strange how Harry's macho instincts had kicked in after Hammerfall.
"We put him on the road," George Christopher was saying. "Him and that Jerry Owen, on my orders. Hell, even the Shire threw them out, and those scummy jerks tried to live by stealing off the rest of us. And Owen tried teaching communism to my ranch hands. Beck comes back in over my dead body."
There was a chuckle from the back of the room, from either Leonila Malik or Peter Jakov. No one paid any attention. There was nothing humorous in the situation, and Harry wondered if he'd gone too far.
"While you're discussing Hugo Beck, Dr. Forrester is about dead on his feet," Harry said. "Can you do something for him, or does it depend on getting Beck settled first?"
Al Hardy didn't look away from the center of the room, where Christopher was glaring at Beck. "Eileen," he called, "take Dr. Forrester out to the kitchen and take care of him."
"Right."
Eileen came in. She must have been standing in the hall. She led Dan Forrester out. The astrophysicist followed woodenly, clearly about to pass out from exhaustion. Hugo Beck licked his thick lips.
"I'll settle for a meal," Hugo said, sweating. "Hell, I'd settle for a stale soda cracker. I just want to know you're still here."
That earned him puzzled looks. "We're here," said Al Hardy. "Have you got information or not? I haven't wakened the senator yet, and he wants to talk to Harry." Hugo gulped.
"I've been with the bandits, the new Brotherhood Army."
"Son of a bitch," Deke Wilson said. "How long?" Al Hardy demanded. He was suddenly alert. "Did you learn anything?"
"Or," Christopher asked, "did you just run the first chance you got?"
"I learned enough to want my damn brain wiped clean," Hugo said,
and Harry nodded. It was the strict truth. "Maybe you'd better tell us," Hardy said. He turned toward the kitchen. "Alice, get us a glass of water." He's got their attention, Harry thought. Now, goddammit, talk like a man.
"There are over 1,000 of them,"
Hugo said. He watched Deke Wilson flinch at that.
"Maybe 10% are women, maybe more. It doesn't matter much. Most of the women are armed. I couldn't tell who was really in charge. It seems to be a committee. Other than that, they're pretty well organized. But God, they're madder than hatters. This crazy preacher is one of the leaders,"
Deke Wilson broke in.
"Preacher? Did they give up cannibalism then?"
Hugo swallowed and shook his head.
"No. The angels of the Lord have not given up cannibalism."
"I better get the senator." Al Hardy left the room. Alice Cox came in with a glass of water and looked around uncertainly.
"Just put it down on the table," George Christopher said. "Hugo, you may as well wait to tell your story."
Hugo said,
"I told you why I left the Shire. My own land. Mine, damn it. They were giving me twice the work of anyone else. After Hammerfall, they said their claim on the land was as good as anybody's, right? All of us equals, just the way I set it up. Well, every damned one of them had to prove he was my equal some way. Now they all had the chance."
Nobody looked.
"All I want is work and a place to sleep," Hugo said.
He looked around the room. What he saw was not good. Christopher's contempt for a man who couldn't handle his own hands. Deke Wilson, afraid to listen, afraid not to. Eileen standing at the door, the spacewoman in her chair, both taking it all in and giving nothing back. Harry looking sour and wondering if he should have brought Hugo after all. Mayor Seitz. The mayor looked up suddenly and swung a chair into place. Hugo dropped into it, hard.
"Thanks,"
he whispered. The mayor silently handed Hugo the glass of water and went back to his own place. Leonila spoke softly to Peter. The room was still, and everyone heard the fluid syllables. They looked at her, and she translated.
"A meeting of the Presidium," she said. "At least it is as I imagine such meetings must have been. Excuse me."
George Christopher frowned, then took a chair. They waited a few moments longer, and Al Hardy came in leading the senator. He stopped in the doorway and spoke down the hall.
"Alice, could you ride up for Randall? And Mr. Hamner, I think. Better take horses for them."
Senator Jellison wore carpet slippers and a dressing gown over slacks and white shirt, his gray-white hair only partially combed. He came into the room and nodded to everyone, then looked at Harry.
"Welcome back," he said. "We were getting worried about you. Al, why hasn't anyone brought Harry a cup of tea?"
"I'll see to it," Hardy said.
"Thank you."
Jellison went to his high-backed chair and sat.
"Sorry to keep you waiting. They like me to take a nap in the afternoon. Mr. Beck, has anyone made you any promises?"
"Just Harry." The gift of a chair had restored some of Hugo's composure. "I get to leave here alive, that's all."
"All right. Tell your story."
Hugo nodded.
"You put Jerry Owen and me on the road, remember? Jerry was mad enough to kill. He talked about, well, revenge, about the seeds of rebellion he'd planted in your men, Mr. Christopher."
George smiled broadly.
"They damn near kicked him to death." "Right. Jerry couldn't move very fast, and I didn't want to go on alone. It was spooky out there. Somebody shot at us once, no warning, just zing, and we ran like hell. We went south because that's the way the road faced, and Jerry wasn't in shape to climb up into the Sierra. Neither was I. We walked all day and most of the night, and I don't know how far we got because all we had was an old Union Oil map, and everything's changed now. Jerry found some grain growing by the side of the road. It looked like weeds, but he said we could eat it, and the next day we managed a fire and cooked it. It's good."
"Okay, we don't need the story of every meal you scrounged,"
Christopher growled.
"Sorry. The next part's important, though. Jerry was telling me weird things. Did you know he was wanted by the FBI and everyone else, too? He was a general in the..."
Hugo paused.
"New Brotherhood Liberation Army."
Hugo paused to let it sink in.
"New Brotherhood," Al Hardy mused. "I guess that does fit."
"I think so," Hugo said. "Anyway, he was using the Shire as a hideout. He kept his mouth shut, and we never knew until after Hammerfall. We were probably in Mr. Wilson's territory, and I was thinking about ditching Jerry. Being slowed down didn't bother me, but how was I going to join Mr. Wilson's crew if Jerry wanted to start a people's revolution? If I'd seen so much as a lighted window, I'd have been gone, and Jerry'd never have known where. But we didn't see anything much. A truck once, but it didn't stop. And barricaded farmhouses, where they set the dogs on us if we tried to get close. So we kept going south, and getting hungrier. And about the third or fourth day we saw this scraggly-looking bunch of people. Every one of them looked like he'd lost his last chance, and there were at least 50 of them, and they didn't look like they were starving. I was thinking about running, but Jerry walked right up to them. He called to me to come on with him, but they didn't look like any outfit I wanted to join. I thought it might be the cannibals Harry told us about, but they didn't look dangerous. They just looked finished."
"No army uniforms, no guns?" Deke Wilson asked.
"I didn't get close enough to see what weapons they had, but there sure as hell weren't any army uniforms," Hugo Beck said.
"Then that wasn't the New Brotherhood Army."
"Just listen," Harry interrupted. "He's not finished yet."
Eileen came in with a tray.
"Here's your tea, Harry." She poured a cup and set it on the table next to the mailman. "And yours, Senator."
Beck looked at Harry's tea, then sipped at his glass of water.
"Well, Jerry went in with that outfit, and I split. I figured I'd seen the last of him, and I could get back up to Mr. Wilson's turf again. Instead, I ran into an old lady and her daughter. They lived in a little house in the middle of an almond grove, and they didn't have any guns. Nobody bothered them because they lived way off the road, and they hadn't been out since Hammerfall. The girl was 17, and she wasn't in good shape. She had fever. Bad. Probably from the water. I took care of them."
Hugo Beck said it defiantly.
"And I earned my keep, too."
"What did you live on?"
Mayor Seitz asked.